KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. And coming up next on this special Memorial Day edition of Forum, two interviews from Forum's archives. First, military historian Max Boot, the author of The Savage Wars of Peace, will join us to talk about his new book, Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to present. He's a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and has served as a military advisor on Iraq and Afghanistan. Then at 9:30, author and trend spotter Douglas Rushkoff will join us. He says humans are living in the present more than ever before, thanks to mobile devices. He'll talk about living in a state of constant distraction and his new book, Present Shock. That's all coming up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to a special encore edition of Forum. War isn't what it used to be, at least according to conventional wisdom, which holds that modern warfare is now irregular and asymmetric, making traditional forces largely obsolete. But military historian Max Boot argues that guerrilla warfare and insurgency are hardly recent developments. Those tactics were actually common for most of human history. Max Boot is the author of The Savage Wars of Peace, and he joins us to talk about his new book, Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to the present. Max Boot is the Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and also someone who has served as a military advisor in Iraq and Afghanistan. When I interviewed him in February, I asked him about the thesis of the book, that most listeners think irregular warfare is the anomaly and that military organization is the rule, when in fact it's just the reverse.
Exactly so. In fact, unconventional warfare, irregular warfare, all of these terms which suggest that there's something weird or abnormal about it, it is in fact the norm. It is the longest running form of warfare that there is. Tribal warfare is essentially guerrilla warfare because tribes don't have this conventional military structure. They don't have command and control. They don't have uniforms, and they don't engage in the kind of toe-to-toe frontal battle which has characterized the so-called Western way of war since at least the days of the Greek hoplites. Tribes prefer to engage in raiding and ambush and stealth and attacking enemy villages and making their retreat, and that's the essential characteristic of guerrilla warfare, whether waged by nomadic tribes in the ancient world or today by various insurgent groups around the world. This has always been the most ubiquitous and dominant form of warfare.
It is really, as you're suggesting, the norm, and the irony is that there's been a trajectory for more massive military buildups, traditional militaries growing, while this has always gone on.
It has been, and one of the great constants of history is that conventional military forces hate to prepare for conflict against unconventional forces. They think that these kinds of adversaries are beneath them because they don't go to staff colleges, they don't wear uniforms, they don't fight in the way that gentlemen are supposed to fight. And yet, every great military force in history, from the Roman legions to the modern U.S. Army, has had to spend most of its time and resources fighting irregulars. It's been inescapable.
Well, in your book, you talk about the nomadic raiders from the Persian highlands bringing down the First Empire. We go back to Alexander the Great, who had these nomads harder to fight than the conventional armies. And the fact is, they have always, even the Huns, the Roman Empire, which you also give us a briefing on and tell some really good stories throughout your book about so many of these insurgencies. But as you say, it's ubiquitous. And I'm wondering at this point, well, how this ties in with what we talk about as a contemporary vein of counterinsurgencies and insurgencies, and particularly the kind of terrorism that is so, that puts the whole globe at risk, really.
It really does. And although this is the oldest running form of warfare that there is, it has changed over the centuries. And the biggest change over the last couple of centuries has been the rise of what I call the three Ps: politics, propaganda, and public opinion. None of those factors mattered when the Huns were attacking the Roman Empire in the 5th century. They matter very much today, however, because terrorist groups and guerrilla organizations of various kinds have figured out how to harness the news media, how to mobilize public opinion, how to use propaganda, and these have become their most potent weapons, something that enables them to bring down a great power or even a superpower, even if they can't possibly compete on a conventional military battlefield, they can nevertheless attack directly against the will of the population that they are fighting and degrade their will to fight and thereby prevail, much in the way that the Viet Cong did, for example, in Vietnam, or more recently insurgents have tried to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. This has become the great equalizer, something that allows even a relatively puny military force to bring down a military as powerful as the U.S. armed forces.
But again, the roots go way back. In fact, speaking about the U.S., United States' use of propaganda against stronger enemies during the Revolutionary War.
Yes, that was absolutely a game changer in the way that the colonists figured out, with documents like Thomas Paine's Common Sense or our Declaration of Independence, they were not just trying to mobilize public opinion in North America in favor of independence. They were also trying to influence public opinion in Europe, in Britain in particular, to convince the people of England that they should not be fighting their brethren in North America. And ultimately, that campaign succeeded. The British Empire still had the resources to keep fighting, even after they lost the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, but they could no longer keep fighting because Parliament turned against the war. Public opinion had decided it wasn't worth fighting. That was a very powerful and significant precedent that would inspire countless imitators in the centuries to come.
We're talking with Max Boot, and he's here with us in studio. His new book, he's a senior fellow for National Security Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. I want to get into some of the American history that you get into in your book. But first, again, just making this connection between the past, even the ancient past, people think targeted assassinations like the Israelis against Hamas or like the drones going into Yemen are something new. But again, they go back to the Republicans and the Romans.
They do. I mean, you know, I mentioned in my book how in the century before Christ's birth, the Romans were using targeted assassination to eliminate rebels to their rule in Spain. This is an ancient tactic, and it's had a mixed track record. I mean, counterinsurgents always think that if they kill a few insurgent leaders, they can prevail. But very many insurgent organizations over the centuries have shown tremendous resiliency and have been able to bounce back and replace leaders who
have
been lost.
Well, you're making martyrs and you're burgeoning more often, aren't
you?
Yeah,
it can often backfire. I mean, look at the modern day where the Israelis have managed to eliminate many leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah over the years, and yet both Hamas and Hezbollah are stronger than ever.
With the help of Iran, one should.
Well, of course, they have a lot. That's part of what makes them so resilient, is because they have outside assistance.
Getting back to American history here, you write about the American Hornets during the Revolutionary War, and I suspect even some serious students of American history don't know about this side of our revolutionary history.
Well, there was a significant role for guerrillas in fighting the British, especially in states like New Jersey and South Carolina, where there was not a significant Continental Army presence. And especially in South Carolina, you had legendary guerrillas like Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, and others who, after the collapse of organized resistance against the British, nevertheless staged constant hit-and-run raids on British convoys and outposts throughout the backcountry of South Carolina and gradually wore down British resistance. And, you know, the British could not stop them, even though they sent out Bannister Tarleton, one of their most enterprising and ruthless young officers. He could not bring these guerrillas he could not track them down, and so they managed to escape and eventually to drive the British out of the state. It was one of the great guerrilla successes of the American War of Independence.
And can you give us a little brief about the quiet American, Edward Lansdale?
Well, he was one of my favorite characters. He's somebody who was a legend once and has now been unfairly forgotten. He actually got his start in the ad industry in San Francisco in the 1930s, helping a little-known garment maker named Levi Strauss to market their products to the East Coast. Then when war broke out, he joined the Army, and eventually he wound up in the Air Force and the CIA, and in the late 1940s was sent to the Philippines to help them deal with this Hook Rebellion, a communist uprising of the period. And what he didn't have any troops to assist him. It was just him out there by himself going out into the boondocks, talking to the people of the Philippines, trying to make friends and trying to organize resistance against the Hucks, which he did brilliantly with the help of a Filipino friend that he cultivated named Ramon Magsaysay, who became Minister of National Defense and then President. And together, Lansdale and Magsaysay defeated the Hook Rebellion. And afterwards, Lansdale went to South Vietnam, a newly created state, where he made another friend named Diem, who happened to be the new leader of South Vietnam, and he helped to organize the new state of South Vietnam. So he had a large impact on history, and it's unfortunate that we don't remember him today because he really was one of the leading counterinsurgency strategists of the 1950s and 60s.
Well, speaking about things that we don't remember as much, you seem to come across with a fairly strong conviction that we have neglected two rather important stories historically as far as American history is concerned, John Brown's attack on pro-slavery interests, which, of course, kids read about in their history primers and all that, but also the KKK against the Reconstruction government, and that particularly seems to be left out of the picture.
It does, and when we talk about the history of terrorism, we often talk about the anarchists or other European groups, and we forget the American roots of terrorism. The way that John Brown, for example, was a very successful terrorist in the pre-Civil War era. And remember, terrorists are generally so weak, they can't accomplish anything on a conventional military battlefield, but they can make headlines, they can change opinion, and that's exactly what John Brown did with his raid on Harper's Ferry, which made him a martyr. And he really mobilized anti-slavery sentiment in the North. Then, of course, after the Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan was fiendishly effective at undermining all those civil rights that had been gained during the course of the Civil War with a campaign of terror aimed at the newly freed slaves in the South and at the Republican office holders who were trying to help them and to enforce the guarantees of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments with their campaign of terrorism. In fact, the Klan in many ways undermined and set back the entire verdict of the Civil War so that it would be another century before African Americans would gain their civil rights. I mean, this was a terrible campaign, but it was effective, and it deserves to be remembered in terms of effective terrorist campaigns in history.
Well, when you talk about the anarchists here in the United States, of course, Sacco and Vanzetti come immediately to mind, but they were martyrs of a different sort. They were not necessarily involved in any kind of asymmetrical warfare or tactics of a military nature or anything like that. But you point out that some of the, in today's world, some of the successes that have come about, in just in terms of successful insurgencies, one has to think about Cuba and Castro, of course, but also in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen fighting the Russians, and of course Vietnam. But the anarchist movement hasn't really had many successes that add up, has it? Either here or abroad, for that matter.
No, they haven't. I mean, the anarchists kind of hobble themselves because, by definition, they're anarchists. They don't believe in organization. But if you don't believe in organization, it's very hard to get anything done. And so as a result of that, you know, they've been around a long time. And in the late 19th century, there was actually, you know, a war on terror that was waged on anarchists. And civilized society thought that they were a menace that would bring down states. And in fact, they managed to assassinate a lot of world leaders, including President McKinley, who was assassinated by an anarchist, along with many other world leaders of the period. And so they created a lot of terror, but they just didn't get a lot done because at the end of the day, they had no program that they could actually implement because they were anarchists.
Is there a way that Islamic militarism comes into focus in this whole history that you've presented for us, this large canvas?
It does. I mean, when you look at the motivating forces behind insurgency, they have changed substantially over the course of centuries. And to perhaps generalize over broadly, I would say that in the 19th century, liberalism and nationalism were the primary forces driving insurgency. Then in the 20th century, it switched to being Marxism and nationalism. Those became the defining movements of our time. Then, since 1979, I argue in the book, the defining movement of insurgency has been jihadism, this Islamist extremism, which came to the fore with the events of 1979, including the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran, and a lesser-known attack on the American embassy in Islamabad, which was burned down to the ground by mobs, the siege of Mecca, which was undertaken by radical Islamist extremists, and, of course, at the end of 1979, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which became this great galvanizing cry for Osama bin Laden and many others. So ever since then, these jihadists have really been in the driver's seat.
It's ideological, too, even though it seems to come under the rubric often of religious fanaticism. It's tied to an ideology and nationalism have always been, other than anarchists, kind of the main ingredients in these kind of insurgencies, haven't they?
It really is, and I would stress, in fact, many of the continuities between Islamist terrorists and leftist or nationalist terrorists or insurgents of decades past, I don't think the differences are that great. I mean, some people will say, well, how can you possibly fight these guys when they're willing to kill themselves to kill you and they're suicidal and so on and so forth? In fact, there is a limited supply of suicide bombers. But if you look at the history of nationalist and leftist movements, they produce plenty of martyrs, too. I mean, look at the way that the Viet Minh fought at Dien Bien Phu against the French with wave after wave of Vietnamese infantry charging right into French machine gun nests, knowing they were going to be killed, but clearing a path for their comrades. I mean, that's as suicidal as anything that any Islamist extremist would do today.
Well, because so many of these insurgent movements or those are doing guerrilla warfare are on, shall we say, the side that doesn't have power or that certainly has less power than what they're going up against. Is there a kind of a martyr mindset in that runs throughout history here too?
There can be. And, you know, one of the defining characteristics of guerrilla warfare is it is the war of the weak. There are not a lot of people, and in fact, really none that I'm aware of, who would voluntarily wage guerrilla warfare if they have the capability to field conventional military forces. That's always their dream, but they don't have that power. And so they resort to these kinds of hit-and-run raids because they're too weak to do anything else. And sometimes, if their situation is desperate enough, they may just throw away their life in a desperate gesture to try to gain sympathy or support for their movement. But in general, there's a myth that guerrilla warfare is the Asian way of warfare. It's the kind of war of a particular culture. It really isn't. It's been universal throughout history of any group that doesn't have the power to fight in conventional means.
By the way, if you just joined us, we're talking with one of the nation's leading military historians, Max Boot, here with us in studio, who is a senior fellow for national security studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, and whose new book is Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. And war isn't what it used to be, at least according to conventional wisdom, holding that modern warfare is now irregular and asymmetric, making traditional forces largely obsolete. But Max Boot, as I said earlier on, argues that guerrilla warfare and insurgency are hardly recent developments. The tactics were actually common for most of human history. You write a lot about figures that are certainly familiar to so many students of history, Toussaint L'Ouverture in Haiti, Garibaldi in Italy, Mao Zedong, Che Guevara. But the archetypical figure often that comes into focus here in terms of leadership is often Lawrence. There are a number of reasons for that, clearly. I mean, he was an archaeologist, but then he became this warrior and this figure of tactics and so forth. And he stands out in many ways, doesn't he?
Well, T. Lawrence was certainly an extraordinary figure. Of course, a lot of his legend was not really his own doing. It was created by this very enterprising Chicago newspaper man named Lowell Thomas, who literally met with him for a couple of days and out of that created this moniker of Lawrence of Arabia and wrote a book called With Lawrence in Arabia, and created a slideshow and lecture that millions of people saw after World War One. And, you know, Lawrence was such a romantic figure after the—
Not to mention the movie, of course.
Well, the movie, of course, for a more modern generation, which took the legend and put it on the silver screen in that magnificent movie where nowadays when people think T. Lawrence, they think Peter O'Toole, right?
Exactly.
But a lot of the reason why Lawrence became such a legend was because after this horrible grinding warfare of the trenches in the Western Front, people were looking for an escape. They were looking for a more romantic figure, and they found it in this very slight Oxford-educated Englishman who spoke fluent Arabic, wore Arabic robes, and led the Bedouin in this war against the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, Lawrence really enhanced his own legend because in addition to being this very inspirational guerrilla leader, really self-taught military genius, he was also a great writer. And he produced one of the great classics of insurgent literature, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is a book which is still read to this day. So, you know, if you can write well, you can that helps to make your name. And Lawrence was a brilliant writer.
A lot of these revolutionaries came from, it's often been argued, fairly well-to-do background.
Some did. Fidel Castro, for example.
Che Guevara.
Che Guevara, they were both, you know, sons of privilege. Che was from a very aristocratic family in Argentina. Fidel Castro's father was a major landowner. Even Mao, who came from more modest circumstances, his father was a fairly wealthy peasant. He wasn't in, you know, at the bottom of the social ladder. And that should make sense because in order to become an insurgent leader, at least in the modern era, you have to have some education. I mean, you really, people who lead insurgencies tend to be intellectuals to one extent or another. They read books, they have ideas. And, you know, for that kind of background, it helps if you have some kind of privilege to begin with so that you have the ability to be schooled because back in the old days, there was no public education. You really had to be born into the upper classes to even be able to read and to have access to schooling.
Talking to Max Booth, his new book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. And what extent is a terrorist organization required to have a support among the population to be successful?
Well, terrorists don't require that much public support because they tend to be very small organizations. They can often be a few dozen or a few hundred individuals. And yes, they do need some sympathizers to operate, but not that many. I mean, look at the way that the Baader-Meinhof gang, for example, operated in West Germany in the 1970s. They were described as waging a war of 60 against 60 million. It was very few people, but nevertheless were able to keep operating. Whereas if you want to have a guerrilla group that actually controls territory, that can field units of thousands of individuals, you need a lot more support in order to do that. And that's a much more substantial undertaking, which is why, you know, in modern liberal Western states, you don't see guerrilla movements. They don't have that much support, but you do see terrorist groups because they're always going to be a handful of extremists and they're very hard to stamp out.
And the terror campaigns, as you say, particularly in the modern context, have become in some ways almost inseparable from putting out the propaganda, which now, of course, the Internet plays an integral role in.
Cyber warfare is definitely a growing area of warfare. And, you know, we've seen a lot of headlines about the cyber attacks that have been launched by Chinese hackers, Iranian hackers, Russian hackers, and conversely, the way that the U.S. and Israel have cooperated to hack the Iranian nuclear program. It's only a matter of time before terrorist groups start to employ these weapons on their own because it doesn't take a lot of infrastructure. All it takes is a computer science degree, a little knowledge, and you can figure out how to launch cyber war. And, you know, that's something where we're very vulnerable because our civilian networks are not well protected. So this is an area where I suspect terrorist groups will attack in the future.
I'm afraid that I think the same about drones. I mean, the Iranians have one of our leading technological drones, and it can't be too far away that there will be groups that are perhaps operating out of places that are rogue states or that are states that where you can't find the fingerprints of where the drones are coming from, where drones might be hitting us.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Hezbollah has already operated some drones over Israel. It's only a matter of time. I mean, it's the height of hubris to think that technologies like drones are going to stay the preserve of the United States. They always spread all over the world and fall into the hands of our enemies as well as our friends. It's inevitable. That's one of the lessons of history.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was military advisor and historian Max Booth discussing his recent book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to Present. He's a senior fellow for national security studies on the Council on Foreign Relations and has served as a military advisor on Iraq and Afghanistan. Stay with us for more programs from our archives.